Okay, let's go ahead and begin. So what I'm going to be talking about today is some preliminary numerical simulations that I've done of the gravitational collapse of axisymmetric real waves. So this is work done in collaboration with Comer Duncan. And I should warn you that this is work in progress in the following sense. What I have is a code that works, but it doesn't work well enough to do the physics that I want to do with it. And that will become a little bit clearer as we go on. So let me start with the motivation. Basically, I have to tell you, you know, sort of why anyone would want to care about this. And in particular, since this is a conference about colliding black holes, I have to explain why in a world where everyone is doing 3D, we should care about axisymmetric simulations. Then I'll talk about two sort of new methods that we've developed to get sort of a stable and accurate code. I'll tell you a little bit more about the variables used, show you some results, tell you what I might want to do next, and then we'll be done. Okay, so motivation. Why should anyone care about this, and in particular, why should a conference about colliding black holes care about this? So the first thing has to do with sort of this conference, and the idea is that even though you need a 3D code to do colliding black holes in orbit around each other, that doesn't mean that we ought to give up on axisymmetry. In fact, axisymmetric codes can be very useful as sort of test cases for 3D codes. You try something out in axisymmetry first, you get more resolution in axisymmetry, and so if you're doing something with your 3D code, you might want to check it against an axisymmetric code, see if they get the same answer. In fact, I was sort of a little bit surprised that people aren't doing a lot of this already. And when I ask people how come they're not doing it, what they say is, well, look, when you have axisymmetry, you have these coordinate singularities on the axis, and we've fought those numerically for years, and now that we've gone to Cartesian coordinates, we don't have to do it anymore, and we're not going back. and that's a perfectly reasonable point of view, but in fact, I have something important to say about that today. Namely, I have some numerical methods that haven't been tried before that make those coordinate singularities on the axis much more benign. In fact, I believe that using those methods, this coordinate singularity, this really isn't much of a numerical problem, and people ought to go ahead and write some axisymmetric codes and try out things like various outer boundary conditions, various equations of motion, black hole excision schemes, etc., and compare the axisymmetric codes to 3D codes. So I think in some sense, especially with these methods I'll be talking about, that this can become an important part of the 3D and colliding black hole method. Okay, so that's the sort of this conference stuff. Okay, now what about the sort of code itself? What one might want to do with it? So here are two sort of important physics problems that I'm hope to be able to do with this code, but can't quite do yet. One has to do with critical collapse. So let's see. Critical gravitational collapse is discovered by Matt. The fact that if you collapse a bunch of matter or gravity waves, then you find that there's some critical value of the amplitude at which you just barely form a black hole, and all sorts of interesting stuff happens near that critical point. So this has basically been studied with great accuracy in spherical symmetry with all sorts of types of matter, and it's been studied by Abrahams and Evans with only a sort of moderate amount of accuracy. So in order to see what's really going on here, one would like sort of more accurate codes to do this. So that's sort of a hope for this approach. And then The next physics project to do has to do with some old results due to Shapiro and Tucholsky. Basically, they made a claim that they had found numerically a naked singularity and had disproved cosmic censorship. And the idea is that what they did was in maximal splicing, to collapse a highly prolate configuration of collisionless matter, and what they found was a curvature singularity, or at least curvatures getting very big, with no formation of an apparent horizon. So one thing that one might want to know is, is that actually a naked singularity, or is it an artifact of the type of matter they use, or an artifact of the numerical method they use, or an artifact of the slicing they use? And so for that reason, it would be nice to at least sort of get rid of the matter and see if you get the same thing. So the idea is to look at the collapse of prolate Brill waves and see whether in maximal slicing you also get curvature blowing up without formation of an apparent horizon. Now, if you do get something like this, that doesn't mean it's a naked singularity. Then you have to look at other slicings and see whether some of them might have apparent horizons, or look at geodesics and see whether you have an event horizon. So this would be sort of a first step, not a last step. So these are sort of things that one might want to do, and things that I'm sort of building up towards with this code. I should mention that this is sort of not the only axisymmetric code around. The group at GOLM has a very clever way of using a 3D code to act as an axisymmetric code. And they may very well be in a good position to tackle problems 2 and 3 as well. And Matt and his collaborators are writing an axisymmetric code, which also might be very good for these problems. Right. So that wouldn't work for critical collapse. So now let me try to deliver on this claim that the axis really is not that bad after all. So typically, if you put in an axis, you have potentially two coordinate singularities to deal with. One is the singularity on the axis itself, and then the other is a possible origin singularity, a place where the radial component, whatever it is, goes to zero. So as Baron says, one way to get rid of that radial coordinate singularity is to just put in a black hole, and so the place where R went to zero is just not there anymore, and so you only have the axis singularity to deal with. Oh yeah, that's right. This R is the distance to the rotation axis. Yeah, I'm getting to that in a second. Yeah, I guess I shouldn't use the letter R to mean two different things. It'll create an enormous amount of confusion. So let me show you the ingredients of how to get the axis not to cause any problems. So the first ingredient is, instead of using spherical type coordinates, use cylindrical coordinates. So in this case, you have basically coordinates like TZ. This R, as Peter says, is not distance from an origin, it's distance from the axis. And then this angular coordinate phi that nothing depends on. So when you do things this way, what you find is that there's no extra singularity at the origin. The only coordinate singularity is where this cylindrical radius goes to zero.
In those coordinates, if you just map that to that plus a constant or so, you get exactly the same picture, and I don't see why there's any origin at all.
What's that?
I don't see how you define the origin in those coordinates.
Well, that's what I'm saying. There is no origin. So the idea is that if you use spherical coordinates, there's a place where the spherical radius vanishes, and that is yet another coordinate singularity that spherical coordinate systems have to deal with. But if you use cylindrical coordinates, there is a coordinate singularity where the cylindrical radius goes to zero, but that's the only coordinate singularity in the business. So all I'm saying is that if you use cylindrical coordinates, you have one coordinate singularity to deal with, not two. Okay, so this is sort of a modest improvement, but I still have to tell you how to deal with this one. Okay, so roughly speaking, the idea is that the axis is an interior point in the space-time, but the computer doesn't know that. As far as the computer is concerned, the axis is the edge of my grid, and you better tell me what's happening there because somehow the equations aren't telling me. So let me tell you basically how this happens. If you look at the components of tensors in this coordinate system, what you find is that regularity at the axis implies that various components of the tensors are either even functions of R or odd functions of R. So odd functions of R have to vanish at R equals 0. Even functions of R have to have their derivatives vanish at R equals 0. So as far as the computer is concerned now, that's very simple. I have some quantity, and what I do at the axis is either set it equal to 0 or set its derivative equal to 0, and that's enough. Or almost. And here is sort of the tricky point of this business, which Peter pointed out to me about a year and a half ago, namely that that's the whole story if you're dealing with scalars or vectors, but if you're dealing with tensors, then you get various objects where both the quantity and its derivative have to vanish at the axis. And that is a really nasty numerical thing because here you have two conditions that you have to impose, and the computer is only going to let you impose one. But there's a simple way around that, and the way around that is the following. Suppose I have a quantity that's of order R squared. Well, I can just divide by R and get a quantity that's of order R, or I can divide by R squared and get a quantity that's of order 1. Either way, by taking the quantity of whatever order, dividing by however many powers of R you need, you can obtain all of the quantities that you need as things that either vanish at the axis or the derivative vanishes at the axis, but not both. Yeah?
Why is it bad for why the computer not like the function is 0 to 0?
Because what you have is all the points except the one at the edge of the grid. You fix the values of things by the field equations, and then you get to impose one extra piece of information at the edge of the grid. So at that edge of the grid, you only get to give a value of the function, and so you can basically either say, well, that's 0, or that's whatever it was at the next piece of the grid, and the first way sets the function to 0, and the second way sets its derivative equal to 0. But there's no way you can do both with just one piece of information. So this is actually fairly straightforward, there's a very small number of quantities that sort of threaten to go like higher powers. You just divide by the appropriate power of R, and all this works. And then with a little fiddling with the equations, you can also make sure that every single term in the equations is either even or odd, and so there's no delegate cancellation in order to make this work. Oh, you can do that too. Either way it will work. Yeah, there's nothing. I mean, so what I did was just to sort of pick a power of R that made the equations look simpler. And in practice, I ended up dividing by one power of R, but there's no particular reason why you have to do that. In fact, when I applied this method to Gaudi spacetimes on S2 cross S1 cross R, I found myself dividing by R squared instead of R, and that, you know, seemed to make the equation simpler. But there's... As near as I can tell, as far as numerics goes, you're free to do either one, and either one should give you a stable and accurate numerical method. Okay, so now we've got everything. So now we've just got a boundary at the axis, and we've got everything in terms of quantities where either the quantity vanishes or its derivative vanishes, and we want to impose that condition in a nice accurate way. And the easiest way to do that is to use what's called the method of ghost zones. So normally you would think, well, let me just put my first grid point right at R equals 0. But it turns out to be easier to put this first grid point actually at R equals minus dr over 2. So roughly speaking, here's my first grid point, here's my second grid point. This dotted line is essentially where the axis is. So now if I have a quantity that's supposed to vanish at the axis, I impose that as a numerical condition by setting its value at grid point 1 equal to minus its value at grid point 2. And if I want the derivative to vanish at the axis, I impose that as the quantity at 1 is equal to the quantity at 2. So this is sort of a nice, accurate way of imposing both of these conditions on the same grid. So when I started this business, I thought I was going to, you know, spend an enormous amount of time and effort trying to get the axis to be stable, and then once that was done, you know, everything else would be easy. But I thought that way because I didn't know nearly enough about numerical relativity. Now that I've learned a little bit more, what I found is that getting the axis to be regular was comparatively simple, and getting the outer boundary to be nice and regular and stable was a nightmare. So finally, in an act of desperation, I tried something crazy that actually seems to work. So let me sort of tell you what that is. This is actually a sort of unusual feature of this code, but as I'll explain, it's also one of the main disadvantages of the code. So the crazy idea is actually fairly simple. We have these coordinates, z and r, that go off to infinity. But in general relativity, we're free to do any coordinate transformations we want. And in particular, we can do a coordinate transformation such that the new coordinate has a finite range. And so in particular, consider introducing coordinate z tilde and r tilde so that z is tangent of z tilde and r is tangent of r tilde. So now z tilde goes between minus pi over 2 and pi over 2. Well, or if I impose reflection symmetry, it can go from 0 to pi over 2, just using part of the grid. And r tilde goes from 0 to pi over 2. So now spatial infinity is at a finite place on the grid. It's all those points with z tilde equals pi over 2 or minus pi over 2, or with r tilde equals pi over 2. What that means is that if I now want to impose boundary conditions at the outer boundary of the grid, all I have to do is ask how do fields behave at spatial infinity and impose that they behave that way. So in particular, at spatial infinity, the extrinsic curvature is 0, the lapse is 1, the shift is 0, the metric is diagonal 1, 1, 1, and I just put that down, and that's the outer boundary condition. So let me sort of explain why this looks crazy but actually isn't. The reason why it looks crazy is that, in some sense, this is a singular coordinate transformation. And so what that means is that if I do this coordinate transformation, then various components of the metric are doing all sorts of nasty things. So it's sort of a useful exercise, though, to just take the flat space wave equation in cylindrical coordinates and go ahead and do this coordinate transformation and see what the metric looks like and see what the wave equation looks like. And what you find is that the metric does indeed blow up, but you don't care because what appears in the wave equation is actually the inverse metric, and the inverse metric is going to 0. And so what's really happening at spatial infinity in the wave equation is that time derivatives are going to 0, which is exactly what they're supposed to do because nothing changes at spatial infinity. So what that means is that even though this looks like a very nasty thing to do, numerically and I guess possibly analytically too, it's completely benign. So the advantages are that you get a simple outer boundary condition. It's legal because you're not losing any information. Nothing is leaking off the grid. And it's stable in that it doesn't, you know, make anything nasty happen. Nothing, no reflections, nothing going off the code. So this is sort of the idea. Yeah?
Yeah, once
we don't have Yeah, once the wave actually is no longer resolved, as I'll get to in a second, then in some sense all bets are off. But the point is that nothing funny, in some sense, nothing funny is going on with the grid. You want to think of this as sort of a regular grid on which I'm writing a curved space wave equation. And so there's nothing wrong with using a curved space wave equation on a grid. But in any numerical code, if you have waves that are not well resolved by the grid, then you should not believe the results of the code, and this is no exception. So that sort of brings me to the major disadvantage of this approach, one that you know will possibly kill it, namely because of this use of coordinates, as waves go further and further out, then a wave of a given physical size gets resolved on fewer and fewer grid points, and finally it reaches the place where there are too few grid points to resolve the wave, and then you can't believe things anymore. So this is, against sort of this sort of long list of advantages, there's one sort of nasty disadvantage which may very well be enough to kill this approach. Yeah, go ahead, Abhay.
It's really about this same question. I am asking this to you as well as numerical people, because I've heard this idea before. And the reaction of the numerical people was that when you put in the baby with a bathwater, but you need some kind of gas. And then we want to know how the energy goes out or something. And we want to have any of the reserves. And so, why is this useful? In other words, I know that this is almost fatal. So
no, well, there's a simple answer, right? You can do a conversion test and you can see what the accuracy is at a given point. And,
right.
But I mean, historically, stretching the coordinates has been a standard in numerical relativity. Every NTSA code ever written uses an exponential radial coordinate. So
the problem is if you do the conversion test, so reading of waves at larger and larger distances for the code and then it's converted, then the answer you get is no wave.
No, but you don't do it at larger and larger distances. You fix it.
Yeah, if you fix a time. Yeah.
Fix the extraction radius. Obviously, if you keep pushing the distance out, you're always going to get into problems.
Lapse equals 1, shift equals 0, extrinsic curvature equals 0, metric equals diagonal 111. It's spatial infinity. Waves don't get to spatial infinity, so the metric really is nice and simple.
But I think what Peter was suggesting is to think of what's happening here. You should imagine this changing the grid spacing in some sense effectively changes the velocity of light, and so you've got a change. You're getting reflections from that, or it may add dissipative terms.
But all that again,
keeps pushing out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you try to extract the wave amplitude to a fixed radius, you should be able to convert.
Yeah.
You have to worry about even that. If you run too long, the waves will come.
Yeah, that's certainly true. Well, or worse than that. I mean, if I run so that things are not well resolved, then since I'm solving elliptic equations as well as hyperbolic equations, nastiness at the edge could propagate to the entire grid. And in fact, I'll show you something a little bit later that looks like it might be that. Yeah.
Well, that's another option, but it's not going to solve this kind of, it's not going to solve the bunching up problem.
Yeah. Well, I was going to get to this sort of at the end. But yeah, another possibility to sort of save this approach is to use adaptive mesh refinement. So a natural reaction to that would be, well, you know, gee, you're just going to have to throw an enormous number of points at this in order to resolve things. But I think in some sense it's not as bad as that. What you find is that as time goes on, the number of the width of the wave in grid points goes down like 1 over t squared. So that means that if you want to resolve the waves at later and later times, then you do have to keep on throwing more and more grid points. But compare that to what happens when you get the formation of an apparent horizon. Then you have this plunge of the lapse and things go exponentially, and there you really have to throw an enormous number of grid points. So what people usually say about this plunge of the lapse is you're throwing an outrageous amount of grid points at a region that you really don't care about. In this case, though, what you want to resolve is the outgoing waves. And the nice thing about this is that you're not putting any uncertainty in the outgoing waves because you're doing something that's completely legal and that doesn't lose any information. So I would claim that if you tried to use adaptive mesh refinement with a method like this, that you'd be throwing a moderately large number of points at a region that you really do care about. So I don't think it's that bad.
Wave pulse is spreading outer, then you need a certain amount of grid points to resolve the R wave length. But now, if this is spreading outer, the volume of this shallow field expands. So to resolve that with the constant number of grid points in R direction, you need more and more grid points.
That's only reasonable.
If you compact it by a long hyperboloidal slice, you get that free.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, even in Cartesian
coordinates. Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's true. I mean, as far as...
I think we should wait until the waveforms are in before we start deciding who's doing their job, right? So,
well... Well, yeah, but that's another point too. I mean, I think it's a good idea to try this approach just to compare with other approaches and see what they do. And I should mention, as far as 3D goes, there's nothing that prevents the people doing 3D from doing this coordinate transformation as well. I mean, you may not want the disadvantages, so maybe it's not worth it. But this could, in principle, be done in 3D. And if you do it that way, there's now no uncertainty and no instability associated with the outer boundary condition. Yeah, Charlie, you have a question?
May I?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
It would be helpful, and at least helpful to me, to think about the changes of these little over lambda, or anyway, sort of typical wavelengths in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Then basically, what that tangent does is it's linear when the tangent is small, when the argument is small, and then it flattens out when the argument is large.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole discussion here is how many. How big is the wavelength compared to the coordinates? How many wavelengths do you get into the region where the tangent is still basically a linear representation of the coordinates compared to where it flattens off? I'm thinking of the arc tangent, but you know what I mean?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Well, so for the tangent itself, comparatively few in the linear region, but I think what you really want is not the question of sort of what's in the linear region, but rather the question of sort of what, how many grid points you have for a given physical wavelength. And for that, what you want is not so much the tangent, but the derivative of the tangent, which is basically 1 over cosine squared. And from that, you can basically show that as time goes on, the number of grid points that you have goes down like 1 over time squared. So that shows that you get into trouble. Yeah, go ahead.
In the boxes, mm-hmm. a subnormal boundary condition, and you grant that, to the box is a thick wall. Usually we don't make them very thick, 4 or 8.6. But this has a similar property that it actually gives you, if you look at what we do to the place together with everybody, it gives you a velocity of propagation which goes to zero. And if you look at the simulation, you see that a paler wave or a linearized wave run up the wall shows its wavelength. You also see that you get a reflection, which is a long wavelength reflection, which basically is the shortest wavelength that sees that wall as being just a boundary. And in many cases in the Grand Challenge Code, that works, and you can run a stable single black hole. But in other cases, it looks as if those long wavelength modes that reflect off the outer box, outer edge of the box, come back in and contribute to the ultimate transfer code. To the extent that you don't have an inner boundary to complicate things, then you can debate that. But it's pretty clear that this is going to have long wavelength reflections from the boundary.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, basically, what I claim is that at this point, I can run this code for a short amount of time, where the time where short means the waves aren't near the boundary yet. I also claim that if you were to add adaptive mesh refinement, then I could run for a longer, you know, possibly as long as you like time, and then the question is whether that's worth it or not. But I mean, certainly as things stand right now, I can only run the code until waves aren't resolved anymore, and after that, there's no reason to believe any of the results. So as it stands, I can only run for a short amount of time, as I'll show you a bit later. Yeah?
Now, in preliminary discussions of this month, I suggested that perhaps you want to compose not trace k to zero, but trace k to t, which would force you into sort of asymptotically null surfaces, and so this would be something similar to what Peterson was working about. And in that case, it was the hope that you could adjust the hyperbolic certain asymptotic surfaces so that the redshift from the surface kept the wavelength as so that there were still 7 points per wavelength or something all the way out.
There's a problem with this. The problem lies in the fact that if you take a hyperbolic surface in space, in normal space time, then the normal of this becomes a null vector. Therefore, if you want to keep it normalized, that washes must become infinity.
Yes.
And if you go to conformal space time, taking out the conformal factor just eliminates this divergence. So essentially, hyperboloidal space-time type of problem in physical space-time.
I think given no matter what Peter's saying, in a more ADM setting, as I'll talk about next Tuesday, so it might be possible to have the best of both worlds, so to speak, and the good parts of ADM combined with good parts of the control.
That would be great. But yeah, I mean, at this point though, I do want to emphasize that this is sort of very different from Peter's approach. I mean, this is going to spatial infinity. He goes to null infinity, and these problems that I'm talking about really are not problems for him. So anyway, why don't I go ahead and go on? Okay, so now let me be more specific about what we actually do. What we do is to write a metric that basically has just 2 degrees of freedom. There's this conformal factor and then this other piece. So this is sort of the standard way of writing the Brill wave initial data. And the ordinarily tricky part is that this thing in the exponential has to vanish like r squared in order for the metric to be smooth at the axis. So in my approach, one basically imposes that by writing the thing in the exponential as 2rs, and then s vanishes like r, which we now impose easily on the axis. So a spatial metric of this form is not the most general one that you can write down with axisymmetry. And in particular, if you want the spatial metric to keep this form, you have to choose the shift accordingly. So in fact, the shift is chosen so that the sort of ZZ component is always equal to the RR component of the metric, and so that the ZR component vanishes, and that gives us nice simple elliptic equations for the shift that we solve at each time step. The lapse is chosen for maximal slicing, and then in addition to these metric variables, there is this component of the extrinsic curvature. Since the extrinsic curvature is trace-free, what that means is that as far as the diagonal stuff goes, we really only have to give two components, not three. And in particular, here's one component of the extrinsic curvature that we have to evolve. And here's the other potential problem with the axis. In order to have smoothness on the axis, this quantity, krr minus k5 phi, has to vanish like r squared. But again, that's not a problem in this approach. Just divide it by r, call the resulting variable w, and just impose that w vanishes like r. Okay, so those are the variables. Those variables now were in the original coordinates. So we now have to change coordinates to r tilde and z tilde. But with two exceptions, as I'll tell you in a second, we still just use the original variables that I wrote down. The exceptions are, instead of S, we evolve S tilde, and instead of W, we evolve W tilde, and we evolve them using the usual ADM equations, except that at each time step, the Hamiltonian constraint is solved for the conformal factor. Okay, so now I have to tell you the initial data, and this is sort of standard Brill waves. Basically, the idea is that you choose some function S behaves sort of nicely on the axis and at infinity, and then you solve the Hamiltonian constraint for psi. And so this is essentially what people usually do as sort of their favorite Brill wave, except typically it's a Gaussian with just one width. In other words, typically sigma r and sigma z are set equal to each other. Doing it this way, though, allows you a quick way to adjust the prolateness and oblateness of the wave. So in addition to things with sort of a spherical Gaussian, I'll also have slightly prolate and slightly oblate ones. And so this is sort of a nice way to test the Shapiro and Tucholsky result. Just adjust sigma r to be fairly small so that you have a quite prolate wave, and then see whether you get a naked singularity. Okay, so as far as the numerical method goes, these are evolved using a three-step iterative Crank-Nicholson algorithm. At each iteration, elliptic equations are solved for the lapse, the shift, and the conformal factor. At infinity, let's see, the lapse is 1, the conformal factor is 1, and every single other variable that I showed you is 0. So these outer boundary conditions are very simple to impose. I don't resolve it, then the Hamiltonian sort of goes away from zero, and on a fairly short time scale, things go unstable. Yeah. No, because if you look at sort of the relation between physical derivatives and tilde derivatives, you find that there are all these extra factors of cosine squared r tilde that are sort of coming in to help you. So in fact, let's see. Let me see sort of another way to say this. Okay, so suppose. There's actually sort of a simpler way to say this. Let's look at how these things look in the tilde coordinates. So suppose I have 1 over r. So r is, I'm just looking out in the direction going away from the axis. R is tangent of r tilde. So 1 over r is cotangent of r tilde. So that's just cosine over sine. But at the boundary, it's just cosine r tilde is going to 0 nice and linearly. So if I look at a 1 over r thing, and I look at it in this new variable, it just goes to 0 linearly. And so that's nice and smooth. That's exactly the sort of numerical condition we want. Here we have a quantity which is going to 0, and it's going linearly. And so we just set it equal to 0 at the outer boundary. So that part actually is nice and simple. And in fact, you apply that to anything that goes like 1 over r, and the same thing holds. Things that go like 1 over r go to 0 linearly in these variables at the outer boundary. Jim and then Peter?
You said that the constraint rule, if you systematically look for how quickly it was growing in life, or just how it was causing trouble, so that just stopped doing.
Yeah, I did sort of a seat of the pants thing that just said, gee, this is getting too big, and after a while my code is crashing, so why don't I try something different? I mean, I should be more systematic about these things, I guess, but really I just took the attitude, let me try a whole bunch of things until finally the code doesn't crash and it converges and it gives me results that I think I can trust. And that's sort of the way that it went. Yeah, Peter.
If you do the quantum compactification, that means that in terms of them, it only constrains the principal partial generated at the bottom. But how is that statistic on the other side means that you get bound from the degenerated elliptic equation.
Well, let's see. It has to be consistent because this is just the Einstein equation at spatial infinity and just written in funny coordinates.
What's happening is the similar situation that I just described here, and what is happening there is the value of psi, whether that is 1 or 1.5, or so it depends on the asymptotic behavior on the coordinate system and the degeneracy of the equation tells you that the psi is starting to maximum at 9 infinity. Now, I don't know how this is in the spatial, in this case, of spatial infinity, that's why I asked.
Yeah, okay, so what I'm saying is that it just is consistent with Einstein's equation at spatial infinity that things behave this way. So so mathematically there's nothing funny about this. This is just a true fact about spatial infinity, and I'm not changing. You can't change the facts about spatial infinity by introducing a new coordinate system. Numerically, you're right that the elliptic equation does indeed look kind of funny, but what I do is to use sort of a standard elliptic solving method, basically a conjugate gradient method with some preconditioning. And I get a solution, although it sort of converges very slowly. So I mean that's sort of another disadvantage of using this. You can get solutions of the elliptic equation, but it's you don't get them as fast as you would in sort of regular type coordinates. So I think the answer to your question is, mathematically, there can't be any problem because there is no problem in the usual coordinates. Numerically, this seems to slow things up, but not cause terrible difficulties.
I don't see why there's mathematically no problem because if you take the compactified psi, mm-hmm. that is 1. That means that this quantity under the coordinate compactification must fall off like 1 over r.
Mm-hmm.
If it falls off like 2 over r, which is the same asymptotic behavior, you must get the psi to 2 in order that the boundary values are consistent with the elliptic equation, with the degenerate elliptic equation on the boundary.
Oh no! This is not a conformal factor in your sense. This psi equals 1 means the metric is going to 1. It's not. I mean, psi goes like 1 plus you know, M over 2R, not you know, something over R. Psi is going to 1, not to 0. So this is not you know, your kind of conformal factor. This is just, you know, some metric component. And setting psi equals 1 and s equals 0 basically just says the metric in Cartesian coordinates goes to diagonal 1, 1, 1, which is what you're supposed to do at spatial infinity. So, I mean, you know, if you discover mathematical problems, then, I mean, that's sort of more than a problem with my code. It's a problem with the notion of spatial infinity. And so you'll have to sort of argue with Abe about that.
But there's a population spectrum. There's a population really completing the space, which is not a conformal completion. A mixture of conformal and projective completion, which gives you a boundary, which is really the boundary that David has, is 2 cross R at space infinity. And you can write down all the field equations that have been taken down in terms of the conformal completion. And you're just using those field equations. There's no need to use this kind of language at all. You're just doing what this is.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so far I've just been talking. Let me now show you a couple of results. I said at the beginning that one ought to compare sort of axisymmetric things to 3D things if I'm to be of any use to the colliding black hole guys. So here is such a comparison. The group at GOLM, using their 3D code, also looked at the collapse of axisymmetric Brill waves. And one of the things that they plotted was the log of the lapse at 0, where 0 is on the axis and at z equals 0. They generously emailed me their data, and so here is a comparison. So this is evolved up to about time equals 5, which is about as far as I trust my code with the particular spatial resolution I've been using. Solid line is basically the GOLM 3D data, and the dotted points are the data for my evolution. And you know, other than a possible slight phase shift, they seem to agree pretty well. If I could get it to sort of run a little bit further and resolve the stuff at the outer boundary, then it would be nice to sort of figure out how things depend on sort of choice of outer boundary conditions or any waves that sort of leak out of their boundary, but in some sense don't leak out of mine. But I'm not to the point where I can do a comparison like that yet. Yeah.
I think the physics of this is just some gravitational wave undergoing collapse.
Right.
So why is collapse oscillating?
So basically the idea is that you have, let me actually say in more detail. So what you have is a gravitational wave, for low amplitude, the gravitational wave will implode and then go out to infinity, and for high amplitude, it's going to collapse and form a black hole. So this is sort of that stuff. This particular amplitude, this is the amplitude A equals 4, is not going to collapse to form a black hole. Rather, what happens is that the wave implodes for a while, and then it decides, oh, I'm not really that strongly gravitating, and after a while it sort of goes and explodes again. So this oscillation is basically, well, you know, some of it implodes, and some of that, you know, leaks off, and what's left, you know, sort of maybe collapses a little bit again, and eventually it sort of all leaks off. So roughly speaking, for something that's sort of completely weak, you'd basically expect, you know, well, the wave would sort of oscillate up and down and then go off to infinity. For something that's very strong, you expect the whole thing to implode and the lapse to basically go to zero exponentially. And then, you know, somewhere near a critical value, you'd expect a whole bunch of bounces. So this is the sort of thing that you should expect from these things.
Presumably part of this is due to the fact that it's a Gaussian, so there's kind of two shells, if you will.
Yeah, well, incoming waves and outgoing waves, that's right.
No, but the incoming stuff, because it's a kind of a pulse shape, it's got two places where there's some maximal action.
Oh, you're saying two incoming waves. I see. Yeah, maybe that's right. Yeah.
opposite to that Faraday shape.
It's the derivative of the field, not rather than the field itself.
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. That's a good point. Yeah. Jim. Oh. Well. So. In my case, this is a grid that's you know about 40 by 80, and I run it on a DEC Alpha workstation, and so you know so I don't need Illinois. But on the other hand, if I want to you know sort of throw I don't know 1,000 by 1,000 points, you know, then my workstation is not going to be able to do this problem. Yeah. So this is still a small number. Okay. So that's sort of one comparison. Here's another thing that the Gohm group plots. They look at the log of the Riemann invariant J, also at the origin, that is on the axis and at z equals zero. I should mention just to sort of head things off that you shouldn't sort of worry about these spikes. Basically, if you take a log of something that's going through zero, then sure enough, you get a spike like this. So these sort of dramatic-looking spikes mean nothing more than that the Riemann invariant is going through zero. And anyway, once again, the solid line is the Gohm 3D stuff, and the dotted points are from my axisymmetric simulation, and things match up pretty well, which means either you're supposed to believe me or you're supposed to believe them or both. I'm not quite sure which. Or neither, yeah, that's right. Well, yeah, well, as I said in another context many years ago, if you have two completely different numerical methods that are getting the same answer, it would be quite a coincidence if they were both wrong, but it could happen. Okay, so now let me return to Gary's question. You know, why isn't it just collapsing? So that basically depends on amplitude, and in particular, the initial data had this parameter A, which is basically the amplitude of the waves. And so for low amplitude, things should collapse. For low amplitude, things should disperse. For high amplitude, they should collapse. And so here is a simulation that I ran of sort of what happens at these various amplitudes. So here's amplitude 4, and things, you know, don't seem to be collapsing. Here's amplitude 6, and things definitely do seem to be collapsing. And then somewhere in between 4 and 6 is the critical value where this critical collapse occurs. But this code, and in particular this resolution, is not good enough to tell you where it is or what happens there. But hopefully that's something for the future. So this is sort of a snapshot of what one ought to do in a study of critical collapse, namely look at a whole bunch of different amplitudes, see which ones collapse and which ones don't, zero in on the critical value that separates the two, and look at the behavior there. And if I could turn my code into a much better code, or more likely, if the Gohm group or Matt gets a much better code, then one will be able to sort of really zero in on this and get the answer. Yeah. Uh-huh. I see. Okay. Uh-huh. Okay. Great. Is that 4.8 plus or minus 0.1 or 4.8 plus or minus 0.5? Uh-huh. Great. Okay. That's good. Okay. So let me now talk about sort of a preliminary version of the other problem, the Shapiro and Tucholsky prolate collapse. So roughly speaking, the idea is you expect in some sense that if the effect that Shapiro and Tucholsky found for collisionless matter also occurs in vacuum, then in some sense prolateness inhibits collapse. So if you look at what happens to the laps, then if you make things more prolate, then they're less likely to collapse. So here is, again, the sort of, you know, very rough version of that study. So this is amplitude equals 4. This curve I've called S for spherical. That doesn't mean that the wave is spherical. It just means that the two widths of the Gaussians are the same. And that's the behavior I showed before. Now, if you make both of the widths still average to 1, but make one of them slightly higher and one of them slightly lower, you can get things that are slightly prolate or slightly oblate. And in fact, what I did was to try widths of 1.2 and 0.8, where done one way it's oblate and done the other way it's prolate. And I was kind of surprised that even that small change in the width seems to have a dramatic effect on the collapse. So the slightly prolate wave sort of goes along with what the spherical one does, but then it very quickly basically decides that it's not going to collapse. Let's see, you probably shouldn't believe these wiggles at the end. I think this is an example of sort of what Richard was talking about with waves reflecting off of the boundary. But other than that, I think you can trust this curve. And then the corresponding slight amount of oblateness makes things collapse a lot more. So this thing at 4 that used to be subcritical is now supercritical. Yeah, Baron? Uh-huh. In more directions. Well, why isn't that true for the matter? Yeah, but see that's so this okay. So it's too bad that Saul and Stu aren't here, because they basically, you know, sort of make a big point at every talk that they've given on this that collisionless matter is not dust, right? I mean, collisionless matter is basically a gas with random velocities of the particles, and so gases like to disperse too. Their initial condition? Yeah, I think so. Sure, but anyway, so the point is that I think in both cases the gravitational waves and the collisionless matter left to themselves the things want to disperse, but gravity wants to pull them together, and then there's this competition between the two of them. It may very well be true that and I think you're probably right that you know, massless waves have more of a tendency to disperse than collisionless matter does. But I don't know, so I don't know how much of that is responsible for what's going on here. Okay, so does that answer your question? Okay, great. So this is still, you know, sort of the cartoon version of what one would want to do to sort of resolve the Shapiro-Wintokolsky thing. You'd have to go to sort of much more prolate than this, and also see whether by cranking up the amplitude and cranking up the prolateness, you could actually get curvature scalars to blow up with no formation of a horizon. And again, if I can get the code to work better, or if these guys come up with a better code, then one can come up with it with a
sort of gravitational fields in a few cases.
Let's see. You mean at the beginning or sort of down here? Well, I mean, they start off pretty similar, but this guy is definitely collapsing, and
yeah,
so things are getting quite strong.
Of course, if that one's forming close naked singularity, then the gravitational field is also getting strong. So have you looked at curvature invariance to try to estimate mass and estimate m over r?
Yeah, so I mean, I have looked at masses. I've looked at curvature invariance only at the center, but in the Shapiro-Tucholsky thing, they find that the curvature invariance blow up, you know, sort of right at the end of the cigar. So I have to sort of put in a few extra lines of code to calculate the curvature invariance everywhere, and then I'll be able to sort of answer questions like that. But yeah, I mean, here at least, you know, towards the end, it certainly looks like everything is getting weak and there's no naked singularity forming. So to test to test the Shapiro-Nikolsky thing, one should look at this with a much higher amplitude and more prolateness, and then see what happens.
Do these three cases have the same ADM
mass? There's some dependence of the ADM mass on the prolateness, and indeed this one is smaller, and this one intermediate, and this one larger. So I'm not sure how much of the effect is the mass and how much of it is the prolateness. So to answer that question, instead of asking that, for example, the widths, you know, average out to one, one could ask the question, change the widths and amplitudes as you like, but keep the ADM mass constant, and then how do things depend on prolateness? And that is probably sort of a better version of things to ask. Yeah, Peter?
How do you plan to decipher the singularity and native timeline of data?
Yeah, okay. So this is sort of a good question. The sort of first order thing to do is to find out whether you actually do get something that looks like it might be a naked singularity in the sense that you get curvatures blowing up but no apparent horizon forming. If in fact that happens, and you know, finding out whether that happens or not is sort of still a big project, but if that happens, then what I would plan to do next is to look at sort of different slicings and see whether apparent horizons form on them. In particular, if you use a sort of analog of harmonic coordinates, as advocated by Helmut, where what you do is instead of having the coordinate satisfy the wave equation, you have the coordinate satisfy the wave equation with an arbitrary source that you get to prescribe, then by choosing a whole bunch of different sources, you can look at a whole bunch of different slicings. So if these things look like they're forming a naked singularity, then the idea is to sort of write another code, perhaps using generalized harmonic coordinates, in such a way that you have flexibility in the slicing and see whether any of those slicings form an apparent horizon. If you don't find one, I'm not sure that definitively answers the question, but at least it gets you further than just saying, well, there's no horizon in maximal slicing.
So you're not planning to do
I think that's actually something that you could probably do with your code, because you go out all the way to null infinity and you can ask what is the, you know, boundary of the past of future null infinity. But with a code of sort, I'm not exactly sure how you do it. I mean, you could sort of take this code and launch a bunch of geodesics once you have the solution and see where they go. In other words, basically see whether the stuff that stays away from the singularity sort of goes out in all directions and looks like it might get to scry. But I'm not sure that you could do that well enough to actually resolve the question.
I don't see a reason why
I'm not quite sure that. Let's see. Yeah, I think in some sense, those are sort of two different questions. I mean, you could in principle have a singularity which is time-like but can't be seen from scry because it's hidden behind an event horizon. So it might be possible to go ahead and figure out whether the singularity is space-like or time-like or null. But that is tricky because that means that you have to sort of get fairly close to the singularity, so things are becoming big, but you also have to sort of trust the results enough so that you can distinguish between these things. So I don't know whether that's feasible, but it's certainly something to do. But again, I mean, showing that so suppose you find that the singularity is time-like, say. That's an interesting thing to know, but it still doesn't tell you whether it's naked or not. Okay, so let's see. So now let me go ahead and show you a movie. What I've shown so far with the lapse is basically what it looks like at the center. Now let me show you sort of what it looks like on the whole grid. So let me apologize in advance for the crummy resolution of these movies. I basically sort of made them as little QuickTime movies on a PowerBook and then put them on videotape and lost resolution that way. Okay, so we're going to look at sort of a bunch of different cases that I showed you before just at the center. So here's an amplitude equals 4 case. This is, you know, no prolateness or oblateness or anything. Here is the axis, the equator, and this is the lapse now, not the log of the lapse. And so it's collapsing, and then it's deciding, you know, if the waves want to go out, and then things will collapse again. Maybe this is the second shell that Matt told about. And these edges are basically infinity. This is sort of z equals infinity, and this is r equals infinity. And, you know, everything is basically sort of nicely behaved on the boundary. Okay, so here's a equals 6. This is the higher amplitude where things just collapse and stay collapsed. So these things are sort of collapsing down in the center, and then after a while, not much of anything is happening to the lapse. So these contours sort of look square, which looks a little bit funny, but in these coordinates, that is exactly what a spherical contour looks like. So that's okay. All right, so now here's a tiny bit of prolateness, and so I think you shouldn't trust the wiggles at the end, but other than that, it looks fine. So in the prolate case, things basically decide fairly quickly that they're not going to collapse, and everything sort of goes back down to a sort of steady state. And then here comes the stuff you're not supposed to believe. Okay, and so now here's the oblate case. So this is the same amplitude, but just a slight difference in the widths. And now things are when they used to not collapse, now they're going to collapse and stay collapsed. Okay, so that's basically the end of that. Okay, so now let me conclude. So as I mentioned in the beginning, this is sort of not yet a good enough method to look at the questions I want to look at. So what should I be doing next? Well, there's two sort of ways to go with this. One is to keep the existing code and put in adaptive mesh refinement so that you can add points to resolve these outgoing waves. And I think that will work, but it's not clear that it's sort of the best method to do, because it'll take a while to put in the adaptive mesh refinement, and even then you're still spending a lot of points for a region that really shouldn't take that many points. So the other thing to do is to just recant my act of desperation and go ahead and put in, you know, a plain old outer boundary using a nice boundary condition. So in particular, the Baumgart, Shapiro, Shibata, Nakamura system of equations with these Sommerfeld boundary conditions seems to be fairly stable and accurate. So what I might do next, and what's probably more practical to do next, is to go ahead and write a BSSN version of my code and see how it works. And then finally, if this apparent naked singularity is found, then as I was mentioning earlier, the next thing to do is to look at different slicings to see if these other slicings have an apparent horizon. Okay, so that's basically it. Thanks very much. Questions? Bye-bye.
One general question, both to you and to me. So supposing what I was doing is a black hole problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now aware of when it's out of boundary. So one could do what you're doing, that problem also, which is basically by thinking infinity and we know the equation there. So what are the relative advantages and disadvantages of doing something like this versus CSSN?
Well, so let me give my answer, and then you should ask these guys for their answer, because Well, so I know Peter's answer. Peter's answer is we shouldn't do either one. We should use his approach, and that may very well be right. But okay. But anyway, I mean, But anyway, I mean, so the advantages are that you get stability without any uncertainty at all. I mean, roughly speaking, BSSN with radiative outer boundary conditions is probably not a legal outer boundary in the sense of Helmut. And even if it is, you know, or could be made a legal boundary, it's not clear that that corresponds to what's really going on with the waves. So I claim that in my approach, as long as there are enough grid points for the waves to be resolved, there is no uncertainty about what's going on. There's no sort of extra stuff coming in from infinity because, you know, you didn't get your boundary condition quite right.
I actually argue that that's not established because basically what you've done is by a choice of the formalism, you've imposed a kind of boundary condition which has its own collection of things like stuff coming in from infinity, which tends to be investigated in detail. The Dalgard theorem hasn't been studied enough to be sure what it does at infinity either. Both of these things appear to me very much at the level of heuristics that they work. That's great.
There's a huge difference, though. In this approach, there is a very specific, well-defined way of assessing what's going on. All we have to do is do a convergence test.
So that means that's not
a very well-known
test in the other one.
Here we know exactly what system of equations are being posed. We've got a very clean mathematical formulation of the problem. If the thing converges, it has to be a solution of the Einstein equation.
Right. So the question is whether the boundary condition is not correct. So analytically, of course, the boundary condition is not correct.
If it converges, okay, it will converge to a continuous solution. You can then go and check to see whether or not. It's inconceivable to me that it converges to anything other than the solution of the real problem. But there'd be other ways to
work. Okay, let me just give my opinion. Okay, so you do the convergence test, but as you very nicely explained, you do the convergence test not to the boundary, you do the same thing, you didn't want to be too close to the boundary.
Well, I didn't want to be at the last grid point.
Couple of grid points before that.
No, but not at any fixed number of grid points. You still get fixed radius. If you do it at a fixed number of grid points, if I'm going to bound you, that will not be a fixed distance.
Okay, but the fixed radius.
You do it at pi over 4.
So you do fixed radius, but are we the last fixed radius? Okay. And so you want to say that if this is converges, then this reflection of large wavelength that
can
exist
in the limit.
So there's a difference.
There's a huge difference because with anything where we cut off a finite distance and put on some approximate condition, we really do not know the relationship between that solution and the solution of the real problem.
But put it differently. One doesn't know anything at all until they can work with tests or the end of feeling that is like.
Well, I think this is an excellent demonstration of this kind of method has a lot of potential.
Yeah.
The reason I'm asking all these questions is because that is what I was suggesting when you came to the interview. It's all the numerical numbers you expect, otherwise you're going to have the same problem.
It's
good to hear.
Yeah. Well, let me you know also talk about the disadvantages though. I mean, so there's nothing that prevents people doing 3D from using these coordinates, but the disadvantages are you need a lot of points to resolve things, and in axisymmetry you have points to spare. In 3D, you know, they're sort of hoarding every point they've got, and it's not clear that they want to spend a lot of points on this. And in addition, you know, when you do maximal slicing, and even more so when you do some kind of constrained evolution, you are solving elliptic equations on every time step, or in my case, for every iteration of every time step. When you do this coordinate transformation, figuring out how to precondition the elliptic equations becomes much harder. And so as a result, my elliptic solvers run much slower than their elliptic solvers do. So if the people in 3D were to use a method like this, it would sort of slow their codes down immensely, and it's not clear that it's worth it.
What is the condition?
So the idea is that there are various methods of sort of solving elliptic equations, so basically they depend on sort of writing the elliptic operator as something that you know how to solve exactly plus a small piece. Or plus a piece. I mean, basically the idea of preconditioning is just that you write your elliptic operator as one with a closed form solution plus something else. And the smaller the something else is, the better and faster the method works. If you write down Laplace's equation in plain old ordinary Cartesian coordinates, there are a lot of, good ways of making that something else small. But if you write down Laplace's equation in my coordinates, I've thought of some things to try, but they don't work nearly as well as the stuff that works for Laplace's equation. Yeah?
Well, the elliptic determination, do you recycle the distribution on the last side? Because I think that should give you a pretty good estimate for the solution on the next time step.
I had tried various things, I talked to Masaru Shibata, who told me, what the guys in Golm do is they extrapolate. They use the solution on the last two time steps to guess what's going to happen on the next time step, and this is a good initial guess, and you hand that initial guess to the elliptic solver, and it works very well. What I found, And in fact, actually, maybe you guys have some suggestion that to make this work better. What I found is that that helps, but not that much. And the reason it doesn't help that much, there's two reasons it doesn't help that much. One, I don't know what to do about, but the other, maybe you have some suggestions about. So one is just sort of what I was saying to Abai before, namely that the part of the elliptic equation that you know how to solve exactly, the other part that you split off from the part that you don't know how to solve exactly is just not that small. So even if you have a very good guess, you have to crunch, 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 crunch until it iterates to a really good solution. And you have to sort of do a lot more of those than you would in the ordinary Laplace equation. The other problem, and maybe there's a well-known solution to this, is the following. What I'm using is an iterative Crank-Nicholson method. And I'm solving these elliptic equations for each iteration. So the first iteration, you make a guess as to what the new metric and extrinsic curvature is, and that guess is not all that good. So even if you've got, and when you're solving the elliptic equations, subject to the stuff for that guess. So even if you have an excellent guess for what the solution of the elliptic equations is, if you're putting in the wrong elliptic operator, it's going to take a while to converge to a solution. So what I find in using this extrapolation method is on the first Crank-Nicholson iteration, the elliptic equations, take a long time. On the second, a somewhat shorter time. On the third, when you've got a really good guess as to what the metric and extrinsic curvature are, they converge quite rapidly. So it's still slow, but maybe there's sort of a way around that. Other questions?
One thing I would think about is not using just this sort of ad hoc rescaling that you do, but actually do a conformal transformation, not a one-point compactification, but just a conformal transformation. So the overall thing would pull your, which has the same effect, obviously, you could pull it in.
Uh-huh.
Then that might make because of the conformal nature of the way you're solving the conformal constraint, it might make it easier to solve it.
Hmm.
Right?
Maybe.
A lot of these problems are probably due to the anisotropy and the coefficients of the differential operators.
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so one of the nice things with Cartesian coordinates is all
everything is one to one, right?
So all these methods, multi-grid and all the standard iterative methods, two-hour methods, converge very well.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start getting these large anisotropies and coefficients,
that's right. So you need to
have some kind of conformal transformation that sort of minimizes that anisotropy, probably.
Yeah.
I would give up the multi-grid.
Okay. Sounds good. Sounds good. Well, I mean, personally, I think my next step is going to be, BSSN. Because it's worked for these guys, and after a while you get tired, sort of banging your head against one wall, and you want to bang your head against a different wall. After a point, as sort of Peter and Richard have emphasized, the waves sort of get far enough out so that they're not well resolved, and after that, there's no particular reason to trust what the code says, and so running a code, where I don't trust the answers doesn't seem all that great.
What resolution do you guys have? And how long can you run this process?
The answer to the breakout is the subject.
So the last
100 and
keeps going. What about the
not a critical one to answer the crash. The answer to the crashes of 5 and the answer to the 5 crashes of crashes and more.
So you get the critical. So, it would be interesting to see how long yours actually would run with comparable resolution, because you're working at, I think, significantly lower resolution.
So these runs, the resolution at the center is the same as the fine resolution of the 3D Gollum group. But because of the way the grid spacing goes, the resolution becomes worse and worse as the waves go out.
We don't have that. We just juggle our resolution, so the center is barely not under-resolved, but at the same time, the wave is not terribly over-resolved because of the wave of the order. So we have this juggling to do.
Yeah.
So if you were worried that your code crashes because you have some instability in the center, that, say, the mean extrinsic curvature takes off, or that you get personal or something, then you can look towards CSSN. But if your waves propagate nicely, then there's no real sense in moving to CSSN. It looks like there's this fluid observation coming from the defection going to the boundary. Then what you really want is a better boundary condition or higher resolution or something. But CSSN by itself will not give you any free boundary.
Avoid the reflection from the boundary is to improve the resolution. And you know that it doesn't matter. If you increase the resolution, eventually those reflections are going to go away because the continuum solution is going to get the right condition.
Sure.
But in our approach, we want to find a boundary so after a while we know we're not going to converge to the right solution because we're going to converge to a solution that satisfies our boundary conditions. not the right solution. But we don't have reflections, not deep reflections in boundary tension.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we don't have to problem.
Since he goes into the mathematical statement, and he wants to make a real conversion step, he doubles the radius at which he puts the other boundary. So this is part of the tool in this sense.
Yeah.
We are really able to do this for several orders. Nothing to do with that conversion step, which converges the atom filter to the real on conversion step.
Charlie?
Yeah. The other hope is your code is running, you just don't trust it anymore because the waves are not being resolved. The possibility would be that some kind of tuning would produce either numerical dissipation or something else, so that these waves, instead of being reflected, would just fall out of the program of the first.
Right.
Right, and those are ways about which you definitely care, right? All you want to see is a black hole form or not form.
That's right.
Yeah.
So there may be some
there could be some finite radius inside of that if you really wanted to know how much was being radiated. You might be able to do some wave extraction at a fixed radius inside of it, where the dot dissipation was having a significant effect.
Yeah, so Karsten suggested that I might just want to go ahead and add a little bit of artificial viscosity to the code so that as the waves cease to be resolved, they basically lose amplitude and disappear. And that sounds similar to what Richard was saying the Grand Challenge already does, except maybe a little bit more gentle than just saying we'll do it with the last 8 grid points. So one could regard this as sort of another type of outer boundary condition, not this time an exact outer boundary condition, but one that's hopefully, in some sense, benign.
The only problem is with this solution is the standard equation to kill off the energy.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Now, if you're radiating a significant energy from here, Vince?
Loose fine type reduction you can do for a one killing field, you know, go to these wave map variables instead of working directly with four metric variables. And Roger Obey wrote a code for cosmology many years ago, was fully constrained, but it's much easier with regard to boundary conditions because it's just periodic. Did you ever think about that?
Oddly enough, that was actually the first approach that Comer and I tried, but we were sort of too clever for ourselves. What we did was to notice, as you say, that when there's one killing field, you can look at Einstein's equation as being, you know, some other equation in one dimension lower. And then we said, gee, there are all these, you know, hyperbolic formulations that various people go ahead and use. And so what we did was actually to sort of, combine the hyperbolic formulations on the lower dimensional space with the dimensional reduction. So we produced a code that did this, and we couldn't get it to be stable. And I'm not exactly sure why. Well, these Garrosh equations are singular at the axis, but some method like this, you know, should perhaps in some sense regularize them. I'm just not exactly sure how to do that.
Wave equations with lower order terms, I mean, you know, you think that almost have to work.
That's right. There were these axis problems, and we did. So we did spend a fair amount of time on that, but there were sort of two other problems that my naivete I didn't think about and that I think ultimately killed things. One problem was getting an outer boundary condition that works right with that set of equations, and the other is the coordinate type shocks that Miguel has pointed out that also caused trouble. Those coordinate shocks don't seem to cause difficulties in the cosmological case, but they seem to sort of crop up generically in the asymptotically flat case. So anyway, we did try that, and something of that sort may ultimately work, but it didn't work for us, and we chucked it and tried a different approach instead.
Yeah, we're Eric Hirschman and Steve Latham still working on that. So, I mean, it's true that mathematically things look nice, but hasn't turned out to be a kind of thing.
No, I'm sure not. I thought the axis was going to be a big problem when I looked at the equations, and they are singular. Everything else is
sure. Well, I think you can regularize that using this regular axis method that I was talking about earlier. But you sort of have to be a little careful about it. Other questions? Okay. Thank you.